Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health here in Toronto, CAMH. This is a world-class facility. They're doing the work on many fronts. This is a facility that is facing addiction head-on with treatment, but also with research. This is a place that treats people with dignity. And you can help them because May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to donate now and help them treat addiction and build hope. This episode is brought to you by Calm. Is your constant connectivity making you feel wired and jittery all the time? Your phone can actually work in service of relaxation. You can install better habits with Calm. Get it? Because it's your installing. Never mind. Because you listen to the show, Calm is offering 40% off of a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/CanadaLand. Go to calm.com/CanadaLand for 40% off of unlimited access to Calm's entire library. Harrison Lohman, managing editor of The Hub, joining me from, a reporting trip to Ottawa. Hi.
Yes, Jesse, I'm here in Ottawa for the Both Strong and Free conference.
It's good to be strong and free. Listen, on today's show, Harrison, foreign interference. It's such a nasty way of putting it. China was only interfering in order to help. Justin Trudeau takes the stand. Again. And the Menzoid Liberation Front. Should journalists care that the rebels David Menzies keeps getting himself arrested? Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. This episode is brought to everybody by Heather Doran, Kenneth Sloan, Julie Bellanger, Cynthia Stacey, Nolan McGinley, Dave Fisher, Guillermo Acosta, and Sam.
My name is Samuel from the Sioux. I'm an avid squash player and project manager. J'écoute Canada Land pour les balados stimulants de Émilie Nicolas et le journalisme d'enquête des émissions comme The Backbench and Commons. For me, it is refreshing to hear the alternative perspectives in Canada's muddled media space, especially with recent setbacks, including the Bill C-18 and the layoffs at Bell. Thank you so much, Jesse, and everyone at Canada Land.
All right, Harrison, as we speak, the foreign interference inquiry has finally been getting answers from Trudeau and his top aides about Chinese interference in our elections. This is a dramatic moment in the history of our democracy. Here is the explosive testimony that they provided.
I'm not certain I can answer that question.
For the same reasons?
For reasons of security and confidentiality.
No, I cannot tell you how much.
But there's not much more I can say about it.
We saw nothing that stood out as irregular.
I cannot confirm or infirm the existence of any other reports that I cannot speak to here.
Flags can be any number of things. The individual who is going through the clearance process rarely has the opportunity to know what the flags are or to be able to challenge them.
I zoned out. You would not know from that just how juicy and fascinating and concerning all of this is. Have you been following along?
Of course. Yeah, my eyes glazed over there. I was just kind of like flooded by bureaucratic language that overcame me like a wave. I've been following quite closely. I think it's tremendously important, but I wonder if other Canadians have.
All right, well, an attempt here at a quick summary refresher of this saga so far. Foreign interference has been an issue for like decades, but this most recent iteration, I think we can peg the beginning of this to Sam Cooper, at the time the reporter for Global News, publishing a bombshell story about Chinese state interference in the 2019 Canadian election. And what was super interesting and juicy about this is it seemed that the backstory was that Sam had these unnamed sources within CSIS. And then the Globe and Mail followed with their sources, also from CSIS, these Canadian spies, who were so frustrated that they had been raising flags with the Trudeau government about China interfering, meddling with our democracy, but not getting any action. And so they had no choice, they felt, but to go to the press. And one of them ended up writing like an anonymous editorial in the Globe and Mail, which was a pretty unprecedented thing. Cooper's reporting over a series of stories essentially alleged that there was a member of parliament beholden to the People's Republic of China and not Canada. That was sort of the upshot. There was a lot to it. Something like $250,000 had apparently been dispersed to different candidates. Both parties had received this favor. Big questions we were asking at the time, did the candidates know or not? But this raised the specter that, like, could China have installed a member of parliament? And the MP in question, who was the biggest beneficiary, allegedly, of this Chinese influence, would end up being revealed as Han Dong of the Don Valley North Riding. So Cooper is the first one out there with this story, and a lot of pressure falls upon him, tons of pushback. A lot of it from the very left side of the media, who I think are very skeptical of this whole narrative of Chinese interference in Canadian democracy or in Western democracies. Specifically, the Maple called Cooper a spy agency microphone, that he was the reporter behind many shoddy Chinese interference stories, and the lawsuits are piling up at Global. A site called Counterfire called the whole thing a racist witch hunt. Mm-hmm. Denial was the initial response, that he knew nothing of any serious interference in our democracy. A Liberal MP, Ryan Turnbull, had an occasion to grill Sam Cooper, said, how can you, with any degree of journalistic integrity, publish an article that is sheerly just based on unfounded allegations? Ultimately, Han Dong, tearfully in Parliament, announces that he's done nothing wrong. He knows nothing about this, but he's leaving the Liberal caucus anyhow to go defend his name. And, you know, it occurs to me, like, wow, I wonder if this guy has been hard done by. I wonder if there is some sort of witch hunt where just because this guy is Chinese, like, you know, you had to wonder, like, has this guy's life been ruined and career? But then I was just like, if the Liberals are saying that he's done nothing wrong, then why is he leaving caucus? Wouldn't they stand by? There was some questions at the time. I could go on and on. This went over to David Johnston, the special, you know, because the Trudeau government was, we're going to get to the bottom of this. We're not going to do an inquiry. We have a special rapporteur who just happens to be like an old family friend of the Trudeaus, a neighbor of theirs in Cottage Country, and a former member of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation. He's the guy who's going to look into this. And he also concludes that there's essentially nothing to see here. But then he quits because he said, oh, this has gotten too politicized. I can't do my job here. And finally, we're at the inquiry. There's about a dozen other aspects to this and allegations that I wouldn't fit in a summary, but all of them pretty serious. We're finally getting answers. What are you taking away from what's come out so far?
I think you kind of answered my first sort of statement off the top as to, you know, why aren't more Canadians paying attention to this? It's so complicated. You've got to follow yarn being, you know, spread across corkboards. You just described, if this was a show, four seasons worth of episodes, and if you're someone, you know, coming in now, you're on season four, you don't know what this character David Johnston was up to, you haven't been briefed on Han Dong or Michael Chong, the Conservative MP, whose family also faced intimidation. You talk about Sam Cooper. I think, you know, a lot of people saw him as, like you said, a megaphone, but also the sponge that was taking all these leaks. You had him on your show, and you talked about the criticism he faced, that he's just this go-to outlet for disgruntled intelligence agents who want to sort of anonymously leak their displeasure with the Trudeau government, potentially get more money. You know, he returned fire and said, if I smell any career motives and I think they have a bone to pick through their leaks, you know, I write them off. And he verifies his sources with academics, diaspora groups, etc. So why wasn't this guy taken seriously? And now, has he been vindicated? I think at the time, a lot of people couldn't corroborate his stuff because he was the guy getting all the leaks. In some cases, I think it's fair to say that he got them before the Globe, which they fail to mention in their reporting now about Chinese interference. The timing of his departure from Global News. Here's a guy who is the driving force behind the investigations into Chinese interference. And then after having all these bombshell stories, he leaves to go on his own and form a Substack called The Bureau, where he looks exclusively at security intelligence issues. And people are left scratching their heads. Is that a result of him being, you know, directly or indirectly pushed out? A consequences of his stories not being backed up by fact? You know, millions of dollars worth of lawsuits, you know, ensue when it comes to Global. And then a side remark here is his, you know, ethnicity. Being a white guy like me reporting on all this stuff, allegations at one point that the call Han Dong allegedly had with the Toronto consul general, the Chinese consul general, allegedly telling them to keep the two Michaels in jail. You remember these are two folks that have been in prison for hundreds and hundreds of days, a response to the Huawei heir being arrested here in Canada. An allegation made that, hey, maybe we didn't get this reporting right because security intelligence community, as well as those reporting on it, you know, can't speak Mandarin, and that the word, you know, delay their release was confused with immediately, and they sound kind of familiar. So, you know, I think that's where things stand with Sam Cooper, whose Twitter account handle is Scooper Cooper, which I think is fair.
I think this is a vindication of Sam Cooper in, like, the grandest sense. Harrison, I guess this stuff could seem, like, dry or boring or procedural. I mean, every political scandal kind of goes through this long, you know, like, you know, from the denials to, like, this is just sort of the way it goes. But it's not boring. I mean, the revelations that are coming out are anything but boring. We have a prime minister saying he didn't know anything about this, wasn't really briefed, and we're learning there were 34 CSIS briefings about clandestine activity. And the media establishment was initially very dismissive in this kind of way that we get where we're like, well, the public, you know, it sounds very sinister, foreign interference, but foreign interference happens all the time. We interfere, they interfere. It's a big interfere party.
We all interfere.
What's the big deal? And then you actually, like, don't think that this is anything like they've installed an MP to do their bidding. And then it's like, maybe they've installed an MP to do their bidding. And maybe Han Dong denying that he had that phone call where he's actually, you know, it's one thing to say that China got him elected. And we're learning some incredible stuff about how that happened.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk about that.
But, you know, that doesn't mean that he does their bidding or reports to them unless he does. And one of the most hotly contested things in Sam Cooper's initial reporting was that there was this phone call that you mentioned with the Chinese consulate where he's saying, keep our Canadian citizens in prison, or suggesting that that's a better move for China. Don't release them as soon as possible. And Han Dong initially denies that up and down. Now on the stand, he is saying he doesn't remember, and the actual CSIS documents are coming out, which have a bit of a summary of him suggesting just that, that to release them immediately would be the wrong message. Sounds very much like those initial reports from Sam Cooper are correct. Let's go on here. Returning again to the question of how Han Dong became the candidate in the first place, very concerning. Like, initially he had no memory of this. Now he is admitting.
His wife reminded him, he says.
Yeah, now he says his wife has reminded him. That's how he remembers. Not only that there was a school bus full of, like, teenagers, foreign students from the New Oriental International College, who came to vote for him to be the Liberal nominee, but we are learning that he was actively involved in that. And the CSIS documents are saying that this was directly arranged by a Beijing proxy. Now, this is like telling Canadians things. Again, you got this disconnect with reporters saying, yeah, we always knew that nomination races were really hinky and weird, and every party does that. It's no big deal. Nomination races, you know, what are you going to do? Well, when you're talking about a riding where the Liberal candidate is a shoe-in, like is going to be the Member of Parliament, then the decision as to who is going to be the Member of Parliament happens at the nomination stage. And I, for one, didn't know that a 14-year-old from China who doesn't speak English, who does not live in that riding, can be bussed into the riding and allegedly, according to the CSIS documentation, told, you've got to vote for this Han Dong guy you've never heard of before, or you might lose your status and be forced to leave Canada forever. And that's how we get this Member of Parliament. It's pretty good stuff. Like, if Canadians are going to care about Canadian politics at any point, this is a pretty good story to care about.
I want to pick up on these nomination meetings because you mentioned, you know, might not live in the riding. Jesse, how about might not live in Canada? This has opened up and shed a light on how low the bar is when it comes to becoming a member of our various political parties. They are so desperate for you to pick up a card and to potentially vote for them. So the Conservatives require citizens or permanent residents. You have to be a citizen or permanent resident to be a member. NDP, it gets a little bit more watered down. A resident of Canada. Liberals, ordinarily, you have to live in Canada. You don't have to be a citizen. You don't have to be a permanent resident. And as of the last leadership selection, the memberships are free. So what is this? This is the Wild West. This is an operation run not by Elections Canada, but the parties. And like you said, if you have a safe riding where you know that your guy is basically guaranteed to be elected in the next election, you know, it's like a flame for all these intimidation moths to come towards and, you know, do their dirty deeds. It's quite troubling.
So we're at the point now of who knew what and when, and we go back to those initial denials about were you briefed? Because, you know, the allegation here is not simply that China did this, it's that Trudeau was told and did nothing about it because it benefited him. And there's like really interesting stuff coming out from his ministers about that too. What did you do based on these briefings? And what we're hearing is they did something about foreign interference when it hurt them. We had a story Justin Ling reported for us about the Buffalo Chronicle trying to spread this conspiracy theory about Justin Trudeau having some affair with a student when he was a teacher that, like, it seems like complete fake news. Nobody's been able to verify this. Buffalo Chronicle is this, I think, misinformation site. And we did a piece taking it apart and looking at their reporting and finding that there's just no substantiation to this. Trudeau's people went to Facebook and said, this is foreign interference. Mm. We have to do something about foreign interference. This Buffalo Chronicle story is foreign interference. And then when asked, okay, well, what about this question that they're interfering to help the Liberals and defeat Aaron O'Toole's MPs? They said, oh, Aaron O'Toole, nobody who's a Chinese Canadian likes that guy. That's his fault. That's not foreign interference. So they did do something, but only when it suited them. We're learning that. It's interesting, you know, that tape that we played off the top, like they're still in a mode of trying to establish plausible deniability. And they're at the semantic level right now where what they're trying to hinge their defense on is like, yes, CSIS told us all this stuff, but they didn't warn us. CSIS tells us lots of things. And we had Karina Gould, who like had been the minister of like democracy, of protecting democratic institutions, hilariously. And she's asked by a conservative lawyer on the stand, by my count, you received 7 briefings on foreign election interference. Do you dispute that? And she responds, I would just say the briefings would be a variety of actors. You know, she's saying that this is not just about Chinese state interference. You know, we receive briefings about a lot of different actors. And the lawyer responds, the heading of the document says CSIS briefings on People's Republic of China, foreign interference. She responds, okay, I didn't see that heading.
People need to remember this interference inquiry isn't just about China. It's about India. It's about Russia. It's about other countries. But which country is the belle of the ball when it comes to this this inquiry? It seems like China is occupying quite a large space. It's kind of scary in a way to your previous point that sort of disinformation and what interference is kind of in the eye of the beholder. Like, here's a cause and effect. So talk about Han Dong. Intelligence reports show that the Chinese state compelled students to vote in his nomination under the threat of losing their visas and potential consequences for their families back home in China. They potentially carried false documents.
They were given a false address, allegedly. They were given, if ever asked, or, you know, what is your address in Han Dong's writing, they were given a false address.
And what's the response the other day, Jesse? So from the national 2019, you know, Liberal national campaign manager, I recommended that no action should be taken. The bar should be extremely high. So, like, where's the bar? Like, I'm just not sure what to do with that.
They're still telling a nothing to see here story. And I don't know, if you've been covering this government as we have for years, you get familiar with the scandal playbook. And it's remarkably effective. Where do you think this is going to land? Because as has just happened, the prime minister himself takes the stand and must answer these questions. So every effort to obfuscate or kick the can down the road, we're now at the end of the road. Do you think it's going
to
matter?
Well, to your point, like, I think people are also kind of exhausted, right? They kind of maybe heard about this thing a few years ago. Between then and now, cost of living has become more of a concern. You have conservative strategists basically saying that Poilievre shouldn't focus on this issue so much because it doesn't sort of land with folks. But it's focusing on that issue and specifically public pressure that will lead to change on this. What initially happened was David Johnson comes in and he issues this report, and the general sort of feel is like, just trust me, take my word for it. You should give a lot of these folks the benefit of the doubt. I think from the public, you get sort of a frustration. What do you mean I don't have the right to see this stuff? It's about my country. It's about my vote. And then we get to where we are today. David Johnson basically is tossed over the side. And I don't feel like it's sticking with the general public.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. CAMH is like absolutely crucial. They gave us a tour and I met these incredible people who save people's lives every day. And I found out about just some of their programs. You know, they have programs for people who want help right now and have nowhere else to turn. They have programs for kids who want to get high school credits while they're dealing with their issues. This is just a crucial resource in this country. We are losing 20 people to drug overdose every single day. There is something you can do to actually make a direct difference when it comes to the drug crisis in Canada, and that is you can support CAMH, where that money goes right to the people who need it now. If this is an issue that matters to you, if it's touched your life or the lives of the people that you know, donate. Go to CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Harrison, you never joined us before on Shortcuts, and one thing I can tell you about this show is that we duly note stories when we think that our listeners might miss something important. Did you bring something to duly note today?
Yes, Jesse. I'll read out the headline for you here. Before saying that, I will say, you know, in the last few days, you've seen the Trudeau government create a national school food program. But when I saw this next article, I was wondering, you know, shouldn't we be feeding our soldiers first? Because David Pugliese at the Ottawa Citizen, a veteran military reporter here in Canada, writes, soldiers had to rely on food donations because of the lack of military support during Ottawa training. Staff created a food cupboard for cash-strapped military personnel so they wouldn't go hungry during specialized cyber training. So basically from this, you know, soldiers are sent to Ottawa for this training at a place called Willis College. They have to sort of piece together what they describe as a food cupboard because, you know, the cost of living here in Ottawa is so high. They don't have enough money for food. It actually takes about 2 years, apparently, for the CAF, Canadian Armed Forces, to fully respond to their concerns regarding a lot of these costs. They return fire to personnel and say, listen, we've had a high volume of expense forms following the pandemic, so you have to bear with us. And, you know, I'm left at the, you know, Maple Leafs game a few days ago, you know, standing up for the national anthem, seeing this thing that's done where you honor a member of the Canadian Armed Forces and everyone's clapping and standing. And then I'm left thinking, we should probably feed these people.
I mean, you could probably feed both, you know? Don't even have to, you know, pick why you're feeding these ones or not, though. You could probably feed both.
Yes, yes. Well, we should think of the children first. Sorry, I take that back.
Somebody should think of the children. Duly noted. I'm just going to duly note, again, I think, the story of Jaskarat Singh Sidhu, that name may ring a bell. He is the really unfortunate individual who was driving a truck that he should not have been driving. He was a rookie trucker in Calgary, a newly married permanent resident from India, and he barreled through a stop sign at a rural intersection in Saskatchewan and drove into a bus that was carrying the Humboldt Broncos, and tragically 16 people killed and 13 others injured. He has been nothing but remorseful. He did not defend himself. He accepted his sentence. It's just one of those circumstances where you just think, like, could easily see in another life being in this guy's shoes. And it's just a horrible, horrible thing. And I think a lot of the people involved, a lot of the survivors, for their own sake, have come to a place of forgiveness. And others, and I don't judge anybody's response, have not. He was sentenced to 8 years in prison, being released now.
He's on full parole.
Yeah, he's on full parole. And now they are proceeding with a deportation hearing. And there's a lot of angry and passionate talk about this. And some people are just saying, like, hey, nothing special about this guy. He'd be deported if for a lesser crime. This isn't revenge. But there are voices that want him out, I think, out of a sense of, like, just get him out of here. And I think that just speaks to the worst side of us. I don't think that's who we should be. I think that there's nothing that could be done to him from the system that is worse than what he has experienced already for his role in this terrible tragedy. I guess I'm just duly noting that I would like to see a different future for this guy.
Can I bug you, Jesse, about one more thing there?
Sure.
And you can feel free to make from this what you will, but I'm wondering what you make of, given all this, the comments made by former Canalan contributor Nora Loretto. You know, she faced a lot of pushback against some pretty outrageous comments she made when this Humboldt crash first happened, talking about, you know, the maleness, youthfulness, and whiteness of the victims, and that being one of the reasons that this got so much attention at the time. Do you look back on that differently now? Sorry, I'm asking you a question now.
Well, differently than what?
I don't know, than you did at the time.
I feel the same about those comments from Nora now as I did then. I feel like they were insensitive and hurtful and really mindless of the people who are suffering in a horrible way. And they were technically true. And that should not be heard as a defense, right? Like, I think that's technically true. I think that the fact that they were, like, young, you know, Canada likes its young white male hockey player guys. Like, to say that at that time, I thought showed a lack of concern and sympathy towards people who were experiencing tremendous loss. I don't think she should have said it. I don't think the fact that it was true excuses it being said.
Yeah. When it was said and how it was said, I think really matters.
Yeah.
Duly noted.
One final sponsor to thank today, and that is Article. Harrison, are you like a designy? Can you tell an Eames from a Herman Miller?
I don't know what an Eames is. It sounds like some sort of like rare Australian bird or something.
I guess I got my answer there. I won't claim to be like a furniture head. I don't know every designer. But when it comes to furniture, I know what I like when I see it, buddy. That's why Article works for me. I don't know. I like brown stuff. I like wood and teak and leather. I like manly furniture, goddammit. I don't know. I like a lot of different stuff. Article is online only. And that means that you can easily browse through this incredible assortment of furniture, styles ranging from mid-century modern to coastal, industrial, Scandinavian, boho. I don't know what most of those things are. I know what looks good to me. Article prides itself on offering high-quality craftsmanship at competitive prices. I have Article stuff. I've had couches and patio furniture shipped from Article to our offices. I got some stuff at home. The whole process is smooth and pleasurable. So if you want to up your furniture game, get the designer look without the designer prices, check out Article. They're offering listeners of this podcast $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim this, visit article.com/CanadaLand, where the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That is article.com/CanadaLand for $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more.
You're under arrest for assault, sir.
I'm under arrest for
assault? You're under arrest for put your hands behind your back, sir.
I'm under arrest. What did I assault?
Put your hands behind your back.
They've been assaulting
me. Okay, we'll figure this out. Put your hands behind your back.
Police, you're under arrest.
How am I under arrest? You bumped into me.
You pushed into me.
You bumped.
Sir.
I was just scrubbing. I've got my credentials here and you just bumped into me. Who? Right. What did I do? I did nothing.
You apparently pushed up and you punched somebody.
I didn't push or punch anyone.
Okay, we'll investigate that.
Yeah.
What? I was just scrumming Christian Freeland.
I'm a police officer. You're under arrest.
What is your name and your badge number?
Assaulting a police officer.
How is that possible?
All right, Harrison. I haven't talked much about an individual named David Menzies on this show. I haven't talked about this guy, who is a guy with the Rebel.
You're just calling him a guy.
Yeah, I'm not, like, I could say a Rebel employee, a Rebel personality. But yeah, there's certain words I'm not going to use. And we can get to those words later. Some of them I'm not going to get to because of this thing I have to disclose. This is not, by the way, why I don't talk about David Menzies, but it is something I have to disclose. These people are still suing us. I did talk about another guy, another Rebel guy named Kian Bexty, I don't know, years ago now, who does similar stuff, in my opinion, as David Menzies for the Rebel. And for those things I said about one Kian Bexty, no longer with the Rebel, we got sued. And Ezra Levant later admitted, we thought this lawsuit's probably financed by Ezra Levant, even though it's Kian Bexty who's individually suing us. And Levant later acknowledged that himself on one of his broadcasts, that he's funding this lawsuit, which, I don't know, it hasn't moved in months, and I don't know what's going to happen with that. But it is something I need everybody to know about before we get onto this. Now, I won't be chilled from talking about Rebel personalities because of this litigation. That's not why I've avoided talking about this. I've avoided talking about David Menzies being arrested like 5 times now, because I don't want to play a role in like a bit of political theater that I think has been engineered for us to talk about the Rebel and David Menzies and to make this sort of a freedom of speech case, because I don't actually think it is one. Do you have thoughts on David Menzies, who was just arrested again when he was at a protest, counter-protest, both things happening at once around the Israel-Hamas war last weekend in Toronto? You've been following this guy?
Yeah, the Menzoid, right?
The Menzoid.
Yeah, I can't believe you got the number right. He's been arrested 5 times, I believe, since 2019. So 2019, he's in Whitby at a campaign stop with Scheer, arrested. 2021 in July, stop with Melissa Lansman, now the deputy leader of the Federal Conservative Party, arrested. Then there was the famous Freeland arrest where they put out the headline, Chrystia Freeland's RCMP thugs arrested and manhandled David Menzies, which I think, that, you know, you could honestly debate how justified that one was and, you know, what got carried out there. We can get into that. He was arrested last month again. Sorry, I forgot that one. And then the most recent one in Nathan Phillips Square around this vigil marking 6 months since the attacks in Israel. I can tell you that already they are crowdsourcing his legal cases.
Yeah, and to give a little bit more background on this most recent arrest, this was largely some would call it a pro-Israel rally or a Jewish solidarity rally at Nathan Phillips Square. There was a group of counter-protesters who were the pro-Palestine protesters, and it's hard to know exactly what occurred because the video we have of it is from The Rebel, and it's being edited in a way that leaves some stuff, it seems, off of it. But it seems like he's very physically close to a bunch of pro-Palestine demonstrators. He is shoving a microphone towards them, and it's one of these things of like, who made contact first? I don't know. You can see them swatting him away, and he's like, don't touch me, don't touch me, and it gets physical. And then the cops come and they're separating Menzies from these protesters, and he's complaining, why am I the one getting arrested? They're the ones who are shouting genocide, genocide. Why am I the one being arrested? And the trap I don't want to fall into that I think is being set here is both one about like, why is this guy getting arrested for just doing his job as a reporter when there are other people there who are doing X, Y, and Z? And certainly I will say this, there was a protester there who's caught on video by somebody else, not the Rebel, with a microphone, not just another protester, but somebody who was delivering a speech directed at the Jews, the mostly a Jewish audience of demonstrators. And he was just the most rank, the Christ-killing thing, okay? He was coming at them, you're filth, you kill prophets, you killed Christ. It was super gross. He was like directing his comments to children, to like Jewish children, come here, your parents are rapists. Like, I don't know whether a hate speech charge would hold up in court. It did get threatening from this one pro-Palestine protester. He did say things like, your happy days are going to end, you know, you're going to go back to the filth. So you could arrest the guy on hate speech, and then maybe it would hold up later or not. But the cops did not arrest him. They arrested Menzies. And so the way the controversy plays out is an assertion of bias on the part of the cops, that they're biased towards the pro-Palestine protesters and against people like Menzies. And I consider that a trap, and I'll explain why. My read of the of this throughout, like hundreds of protests now, Harrison, is that what the police are doing is selective enforcement for sure. They are not just enforcing the law to everybody. There's lots of laws that they could be enforcing that they're not. But the bias is not towards one side of the conflict or another. They seem to me to be interested in arresting anybody who is going to instigate and create physical confrontation. They don't want these protests to turn into riots. Mm. And that's really understandable to me. And they're taking a really hands-off approach to the protesters themselves. But it seems to me the cops have decided to try to just let these protests play out as long as that can happen without things boiling over into violence.
Yeah, they want to stop those who appear to be inviting violence and chaos. It's interesting on both sides, right? The people feel the police are not doing their jobs. Either not they're not stepping in enough or they're stepping in too much. There are people that go to protests, these sorts of events, to genuinely mourn and be peaceful. There are others that go there and, you know, I went to the G20 to check it out. I've been at various protests. They're looking for trouble. They want to rush. They are primed for confrontation. When it comes to journalists covering this stuff, we would hope in its purest form, like an objective journalist would be there to be the fly on the wall describing what's going on. Often in some of these cases, they're the only ones there to describe objectively what's going on. So sort of a fly on a wall as opposed to, you know, a buzzing hornet, where you could say that, you know, the journalist is provoking some sort of confrontation. This gets more complicated, and, you know, you've touched on some of these themes before, with this whole categorization of, you know, activist journalists. I think the rebel has labeled themselves often as activist journalists, journalists with an activist bent. And I'm sure you're going to get rebel supporters tweeting you after this, saying, what do you mean? This is the equivalent of indigenous journalists, you know, in encampments, or covering certain events where the RCMP or other officers push forward and arrest those journalists. You know, Menzies is the equivalent of them. He's like an activist journalist who is sympathetic to one side, and he's covering that as you would expect him to. What do you make of that sort of comparison?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether or not he's a journalist or whether activist journalism is a legit. In this case, it actually doesn't matter at all, because as you say, that's not why he was there. Like, just fundamentally, the job of journalism is like to tell people what's happening.
Yeah.
If you go to a place and you make something happen, that's a different thing. It might be an okay thing. It might be a legal thing. I don't know what it is, but it's not journalism. I go and I look at David Menzies' videos, and I don't know, maybe there's some news story that he broke or a question he asked that he got an interesting answer to, but I can't find it. All of the top videos I see for David Menzies on the Rebels website are David Menzies gets arrested, give money to the David Menzies Fund. It's all about these confrontations, right? So whatever conversation we're going to have about him is not really a conversation about journalism to me. That's the trap that I don't want to fall into. Now, that being said, I do think that it brings up some interesting and complicated things, because they've yet to make any of these charges stick. So you got a guy who's getting arrested again and again and again. And, you know, people are right to laugh at some of this, because one of the things that he has been charged with in this most recent one is that he is in violation of the Trespass to Property Act. This was City Hall. And if he was trespassing on City Hall, then, like, what about all those other protesters? They weren't trespassing on – it's ridiculous. It won't stick. So I think there's a problem when the law is enforced selectively on this one guy in a way that doesn't turn out to actually, like, have teeth to it. Like, they're just – you know, obviously they're just removing him to stop something bad from happening, but they don't necessarily have the backing of the law to do so. Meanwhile, there are other people – who are flagrantly breaking the law at these protests, who have, like, made death threats, and I think genocidal comments have occurred. All kinds of stuff has happened at these protests, and the cops are not enforcing that. And I think it's that as a result of this stunt or whatever we call it from the rebel, we can have a conversation about how this is going. And I can see both sides to it, because, like, I've never been one to say, this has gone too far, the cops need to go in there and crack some heads and get rid of these protesters. I took a lot of heat for saying that during the Freedom Convoy. I didn't like their cause. I didn't like the effect it was having on the Ottawa residents. But I said, you know, this is a democracy. We have to be able to sustain civil disobedience and protest.
Mm-hmm.
And these protests now are going on and on and on. And I feel like if we can allow these protests to happen without there being like this stern police response, that's probably for the best. But I am also a member of a ethnic minority that is increasingly targeted by these. And what I'm afraid of is not that these protests themselves are going to boil over into violence. I mean, I guess I'm concerned about that. But what I see happening is these protests are getting more and more extreme. They are moving from, I think, legitimate targets like consulates to the neighborhoods of Jewish people. Like both Jewish neighborhoods that I've lived in my life have had protesters in residential neighborhoods. There have been blatantly genocidal things said at these protests. And then meanwhile, there's like a guy shooting at a synagogue or firebombing a synagogue and we're told, oh, that's got nothing to do with the protests. I know from history where this is going. It's not about the protests becoming violent. I know when we have symbolic imagery of rifles and globalize the intifada and glory to our martyrs, an increasingly militarized theater at these protests and symbolism and imagery, that the line towards actual violence can be really, really short. And we have already seen that happen in Canada. And I am a guy who loves to say, I told you so. I really don't want to have to say, I told you so. Like, there have been so many bomb threats to the places where Jewish children go, and you just need one person to say, anyhow, I don't even want to say it. Like, I just hope that it could be worked out in civil society, which is why I'm involved in this like really difficult conversation publicly, trying to get people who just want to protest a war or whatever they want to call it, if they just want the violence to stop, to separate that message from these increasingly horrifically, disgustingly anti-Semitic messages. I don't think it'll work to just have the police come and crack down on this.
And you know, sometimes it's not a conversation like you describe. It's people yelling and screaming and not listening to one another. Like, I'm wondering what you make of the characterization. You know, some media calls the protests Hamas-supporting protests, that, you know, you paint them in one broad stroke. Do you see this, you know, the people doing the stuff you just described, the heinous acts, as sort of a fringe element? Or are you saying right now that it's, you know, the majority of people who go out on the streets in Toronto every weekend?
I believe very much that the majority of people who have joined this protest movement just want innocent people to stop getting killed. But what I see happening is that they're coming to these protests with that objective in mind, but finding themselves very quickly in a crowd that is led by people who have different priorities, pre-existing ideology and mentality. And then it's a hop, skip, and a jump to, I mean, you can see it in that video of that guy who was calling the Jews Christ killers. There's somebody standing next to him with a Che Guevara poster, and nobody said shit. Nobody said anything to stop the guy. So I worry, and my concern from the start has been, and the people that I've been trying to speak to from the start have been the majority of protesters, who I think are good people who have a very understandable goal in mind that is specifically focused on an end to the violence that is occurring right now. And I worry that they are getting involved in something that has very different objectives than that.
So in the UK, Jesse, the police are issuing photos. They're saying, have you seen this individual? You know, he's holding a sign that says this, you know, horrible, hate-filled thing, and we're seeking him. Like, do you think this is something the Toronto police should be doing? Is that overstepping?
Harrison, there's a certain point where whatever my opinion is, like, takes a secondary position to just, like, safety. When the words become actions and you have to turn to the cops and say, please help me. And it's already been that for people who've had their businesses firebombed or death threats. This is happening already. Not en masse. Yet. I would like to live in a society where the answer to hate speech is that I can turn to my neighbor and say, look, I don't really care that this lunatic is saying this idiotic thing, but let's all agree that it's not okay. That's what's been lacking. And that's what shook me like nothing has ever shaken me before and just changed my perspective on, I don't know, who I am in this society and what I can rely on from my neighbors. So I'm still operating in maybe an overly idealistic mode that this can get sorted out in the public sphere, in the civil dialogue I am not banging on the table saying the cops need to do this or that or the laws need to be harsher. I'm still hoping against hope that the same way that, like, I know anti-black racism when I see it and I'll say something about it. I know Islamophobic racism and I've tried my best over a decade of doing the show to say something about it. And right now I'm not turning to the authorities. Right now I'm talking to the world and saying, like, there, they did it again. There. That I know that one. That's the Christ killer thing. Is that cool? And hoping that we can get back to where we were 6 months ago, which was a consensus that that is absolutely abhorrent. And I'll say this. I asked this question publicly when I saw that video of that speech. I said, have any of the pro-Palestine groups denounced this guy or distanced themselves? And at the time, they hadn't. But maybe as a result of me asking that question or maybe not, a bunch did. And Jews Against Genocide and some other groups put out a statement saying we denounce this guy. And then people were like, as if Canada Land's going to pay any attention to that. I am very glad to see that they did that. I am happy to give attention to that. Please push these people out of your movement. Please. You'll get as much of a signal boost from me as you want.
And I think just to add to your point, made all the more so important if that neighbor you've turned to that you would hope is supportive is not Jewish, is different from you, but is still willing to step up and assist.
Yeah. Look, I'm embarrassed. I don't like I don't see any big dignity or virtue in being a victim. I don't want to be a victim. I don't like having to turn to my neighbor and ask for these things. But this is a time of need, for sure. It means a lot when we see people not doing that, and it means the world when we see people doing so. That's Shortcuts. Harrison, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Harrison Lohman, where can people find you?
Sure, you can find me on Twitter at HARRISONLOWMAN, or you can visit our website, www.thehub.ca.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson, with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our production coordinator is Andre Proop. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Listen, if listening to the show adds something to your understanding of the world, if you value it, if you value everything else we do, all of our shows, please support us. The time has come for the people who want this to exist to pay for it to exist. It's the only way. We will shower you with perks and bonus stuff if you do so. Ad-free podcasts, early releases, bonus content, exclusive newsletter, discounts on our merch. We do live events, all kinds of stuff. But the main reason to support us is to become a part of the solution to Canada's journalism crisis and to keep our work accessible for everybody else. Join us now. Click on the link in your show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.